these last couple of weeks, I've been superintending a swampy corner of the infinite inning called the Department of Who Can You Trust. Initially, I thought that this story belonged there. I realize now, because of the ending, that it probably doesn't, but I'll let you be the judge. We should note that the heart of this story, the conflict at the center of it, took place 112 years ago. Theodore Roosevelt was president, the Russians and Japanese were at war, Albert Einstein had just proposed this E equals MC squared idea, the Wright brothers were still trying to perfect their airplane, and one of the hit songs of the year by Victor Herbert and Harry Smith was called "A Woman is Just a Woman, But a Good Cigar is a Smoke." Try that one now and see if anybody laughs. Actually, they do, but ironically, instead of in sympathy. It was an altogether different world from now, with its own manners and mores. For that reason, they might have had a different answer then to what is still a current question, namely, why do you have to be such a jerk about everything? Their reasons might have been very different. But again, I'll let you decide. The Chicago Cubs first brought together shortstop Joe Tinker and second baseman Johnny Evers in September of 1902, and from 1903 through 1912, they were the team's double play combination. That first year, Evers was 20 and Tinker was 21, so you could kind of say they grew up together. Well, not together. I mean, together in terms of propinquity, not together as a couple. They never really got along. They were not friends, exactly. At least they didn't think they were. As we'll see, they might have been wrong about that, but the fact that they kept hitting each other kind of got in the way of establishing any real friendship. They were very good, and the Cubs were very good with them. They went to four World Series together. One of the incredible things about that is that all of those World Series came after 1905, which was when the two ceased speaking altogether. In the ensuing years, each gave a different reason for why they had their falling out. Again, they maybe never had a falling in, but although the story would always change in the telling, and the dates would move around too, they were in rough agreement that the break came prior to or during an exhibition game that took place on September 13th, 1905, in Bedford, Indiana. In those days, particularly in minor league facilities, players didn't always have a clubhouse to change in. These were ad hoc, quickly and cheaply built stadiums. They probably didn't even deserve to be called stadiums. And no one cared about player comfort or anything. So they would change at the team hotel and either walk or ride to the ballpark in uniform. The way Tinker told the story, he and Evers and some other Cubs were supposed to share a cab to the ballpark together. Instead of waiting for them, Evers simply hopped in a cab and took off. And just to reiterate one more time how long ago this was, no one ever specifies when this story is told, but given that we're in Bedford, Indiana in 1905, automobiles are just coming on the market, mass production hasn't really happened yet, and we're in a town that must have been about a population of 6,000 then, I'm pretty sure that when Evers stole the player's cab, we're talking about a horse. Tinker next saw Evers as he went out for infield prior to the game, and he starts jawing at Evers. Who the hell are you to take the cab by yourself? And Evers, who sports writers had nicknamed the Crab for his sparkling personality, was ready to fight, which he was always ready to fight, and that must have been a hell of a thing to see because he was a weird-looking dude. Emaciated doesn't quite do him justice. He was 5'9 and maybe 120 pounds, and he had this big jaw that was floating over this scrawny body like he had just come off the baton. I mean, if I showed you a picture of Evers in his prime and you didn't know who it was and I said, "Here's a picture of a 19th century tuberculosis sufferer," you would have no grounds with which to say, no, that's a major league ball player. I mean, he looked like a lowercase letter I. Once they were broken up, Evers said, "Look, I don't like you, you don't like me, absolutely nothing good comes out of our even talking to each other, so let's just not do it. I'll play my position, you play yours, but that's as far as it goes from now on." And they agreed to that, and they held that until the pair was finally broken up when the Cubs made Evers the manager after the 1912 season, and Tinker said, "I'm not playing for him," and so he was traded to the Reds. Evers' version was a little different. They were taking infield before that same game, or some other game, and Tinker threw the ball to Evers at full velocity, even though Evers was standing just a few feet away. He claimed it broke his finger, And that's how they started into punching each other. The conclusion was the same, though, that they agreed that they never need speak again. Oddly enough, there was still a sense of fraternity there. Evers once said, "Every time something went wrong on the field, we would be at each other, and there would be a fight in the clubhouse after the game. He'd rush at me and get me by the throat, and I'd punch him in the belly and try to cut him with my spikes, and then Chance or one of the other big guys would come to my rescue. But let anybody on another club pick on one of us, and the two of us would jump him." Maybe they should have taken that as a hint, but the silence, the long silence, went on for another quarter of a century or so, even after they parted ways. They both had distinguished post-Cubs careers, too, not just managing, but as players. Evers got traded over to the Boston Braves in 1914 and won the league MVP that year, as the Braves shocked everybody by winning the World Series. And Tinker's stay with the Reds was pretty brief before he went over to the Federal League, but he's still just one of three Red shortstops all time to hit 300 in a full season. It's him, Barry Larkin, and Dave Concepcion. Here's how Evers described the ending of it all. "We didn't speak to each other, friendly that is, until we had been out of baseball for years. We were invited to a baseball broadcast in Chicago. Neither of us knew the other would be in the studio, and when we met, it looked as though we were going to start all over again, and then all of a sudden, Joe threw his arms around me, and I threw mine around him, and we hugged each other and cried like a couple of babies." That was around 1937. There's a picture of them from around that time, when they were at Wrigley Field to dedicate a plaque to Chance, who had died back in 1924. They actually look happy. They're not trying to hurt each other. Evers was only 56, but he looks about 10 years older than that, and he's wearing spectacles, and his eyes are twinkling, and incredibly, there's some paunch on that body. The crab looks downright grandfatherly. I find that picture more assuring even than the 1939 Lou Gehrig picture in which Babe Ruth threw his arms around Gehrig and they famously patched things up after a long feud that began when Gehrig's mother criticized Ruth's wife over the way that she was raising the Babe's kids. I don't fully buy that picture, and I might be reading into things, but at certain angles, Gehrig looks a whole lot less into it than the Babe does, as if he's doing this, he's putting up with the embrace because the cameras are present, but in his heart, he's still a little mad about things. He's just tolerating it. The reason I don't think the estrangement and final healing of Tinker and Evers belongs in the infinite inning is because here, partings are irrevocable. We who were formerly conjoined assume the postures of parallel lines, which means we never meet again, or at least we never recover that mutual sympathy which previously marked our engagement with each other. Tinker and Evers still had it, or at least they finally belatedly discovered it. I think that in some strange, hard-to-explain way, it must have been there all along. In a way, this is a more humane story than the typical relationship drama, because other than a cab being absconded with or a baseball being thrown too hard, no trust was broken. It seems incredible to me that you can fully give yourself to someone and then revoke that status at a later date. Sure, there are extenuating circumstances in which people abuse that trust in any meaning of the word abuse that you want. It's like the old Rodgers and Hart song from Pal Joey. "If my heart gets in your hair, you mustn't kick it around. Even though I'm mild and meek, when we have a brawl, if I turn the other cheek, you mustn't kick it at all." And people do kick it. It's not really what I'm talking about, though. I'm talking about something more arbitrary and callous. Lately, I feel like all our relationships, even those that seem the most solid, are actually a series of moment-to-moment cliffhangers in which, when you least expect it, you might turn around and realize that the other person checked out without your noticing it. This has been a very difficult thing to process because you can drive yourself crazy. It's like those Nathaniel Hawthorne stories like Young Goodman Brown. I bet many of you read that one in junior high or high school. I know I did at least once. In which someone realizes, as the movie trailer cliche goes, that everything he knows about everyone in his life is wrong. That beneath the thin veneer of their otherwise affable, pure, and devout personalities, they are wicked, satanic fornicators who cavort with dark forces in the woods at night. And the protagonist, the title character of the story, is destroyed by this knowledge, even though really nothing actually happens to him, other than that he has this realization. but the rest of his life is consumed by paranoia and suspicion. There's more than one Hawthorne story like that. And they're horror stories, not because of the supernatural element, which can be dismissed as mere fantasy, but because they're so plausible, and because we've seen people do that, pull off their masks and reveal other, darker versions of themselves. One reason why the Shoeless Joe Jackson story is so tragic is not just because a most likely crooked ball player lost his livelihood, but because if you take him as just what he was with his bat in his hands, he was a very pure expression of something that baseball provides us, to wit, that when the player is standing at the plate and he's swinging that bat, or for that matter, when he's on the mound throwing the ball, his personality is irrelevant. What he does the rest of the time is irrelevant. There is just the motion, the swing, the flight of the ball. And in Jackson's case, that resulted from a swing so perfect that it not only resulted in a .356 batting average, but that Babe Ruth copied it. The batter at the plate is a kind of escape. The moment that they step away, the moment they're outside the batter's box, everything becomes more complicated than that, and the meanness of them comes into play and complicates everything. Betrayal becomes possible. And I don't know, having realized that about people, how you learn to trust again. That applies to Tinker and Evers, too. You know, Franklin Pierce Adams wrote that verse that helped put them in the Hall of Fame 3 years or so after they stopped speaking. But the verse doesn't know that. These are the saddest of possible words, Tinker to Evers to Chance. Trio of bear cubs and fleeter than birds, Tinker and Evers and Chance. Ruthlessly pricking our gonfalon bubble, making a giant hit into a double. Words that are heavy with nothing but trouble, Tinker to Evers to Chance. The verse doesn't know that Tinker and Evers weren't speaking. It doesn't even know, as people have been pointing out for literally more than 100 years, that they didn't turn all that many double plays. It just knows the purity of watching them play, and that Adams was a Cubs fan and had some space to fill in his column so he could go to a ball game. Adams wrote a lot of verses like that. He also wrote this. It's called a lament. While she I loved is being torn from arms that held her many years, dost thou regard me, friend, with scorn, or seek to check my tears? Bitter the hatred for a jilt, and hot the hates of Eros are. My hatred, slay me, and thou wilt, for thee'd be gentler far. Can I endure that she recline upon another's arm? Shall they no longer call that lady mine, who mine was yesterday? For love is fleeting as the hours. The town of Thebes is draped with moss, and Ilium's well-known topless towers are now a total loss. Fell Thebes and Troy, and in the grave, have fallen lords of high degree. What songs I sang, what gifts I gave, she never fell from me. So he knew the other side, too. Just to leave things on a lighter note, and maybe an appropriately deflating one, given the heaviness of this theme, another thing that Adams wrote, and something that as a writer I've often had to deal with as well, was something Adams titled, What the Copy Desk Might Have Done to Annabel Lee. Annabel Lee being Edgar Allan Poe's famous lament. Headline, Soul Bride, Oddly Dead and Queer Death Pact. Highborn kinsman abducts girl from poet lover. Flu said to be cause of death. Grand jury to probe. Annabel L. Poe of 1834 and 1/2 Third Avenue, the beautiful young fiancée of Edmund Allan Poe, a magazine writer from the South, was found dead early this morning on the beach off East 8th Street. Poe seemed prostrated and, questioned by the police, said that one of her aristocratic relatives had taken her to the, quote, seashore, but that the cold winds had given her, quote, flu, from which she never, quote, rallied. Detectives at work on the case believe, they say, that there was a suicide compact between the Poes and that Poe also intended to do away with himself. He refused to leave the spot where the woman's body had been found. I'm Stephen Goldman, and this is the Infinite Inning Baseball Podcast.
Thank you.
The apartment at 32 Bleakerson Street seemed too good to be true. Capacious rooms, low rent, a view of the gently lulling river. The only condition? That you take on the two cats left behind by the elderly former tenants, the late Mr. and Mrs. Augie and Diz Stonefrick. Curiously, also named Augie and Diz. Your cohabitation with the felines is uneventful at first, until one day, when Augie is sitting in your lap as you pet him, you realize he is petting you back. The same day, you come upon Diz trying on your emerald pendant as Augie toys with a knife. You shout at them, but both only leer at you, and though it makes you doubt your sanity, you realize that Augie and Diz are not Mr. and Mrs. Stonefrick's cats, but somehow they are Mr. and Mrs. Stonefrick. Instead of renting number 32, you should have moved in to episode 31. Rent-to-own options available. Welcome back to the show. Hell, welcome me back to the show. It's a pleasure to be here, back sort of on schedule and in regular show mode after an attenuated Thanksgiving episode that we frankly barely got out before the turkey carving started. I'm not going to go into my turkey speech again, don't worry about it, although there is a little of that with today's guest, the baseball author Stacy May Fowles, who was kind enough to persevere with me despite multiple scheduling issues on both our parts, as well as a technical screw up on my end at one point, to discuss her book, Baseball Life Advice, Loving the Game That Saved Me. And I have to be honest with you, this is one that won me over, that I wasn't totally sure what I was getting into when I started reading it. And mentally, I was pushing back against it a little bit because her way of engaging with the game is not always my way. I think I'd be better off if it was. Throughout my life, that's been kind of a struggle. As I said to her at one point outside of this episode, I empathize with Groucho Marx's famous remark that he wouldn't belong to any group that would have him as a member. Her book helped me understand that, whereas sometimes that's been a point of pride for me, that maybe it's a foolish one. I decided that in fairness and in open-mindedness, that if she was going to be generous enough to spend her time talking to me, it was only right that I try to see things her way. And as you'll hear, I proved to be capable of doing that, which surprises me. Giving myself over to something, the way that, as you'll hear us discuss, she gave herself over at a time of personal crisis to the game, is very, very hard for me. I'm not saying that I've arrived at the point that she did. I love the game, but I don't know if it saved me. I don't know if I could ever be saved because, and no disrespect to those who invest spiritual meaning in that word, saved. That's just not me. It's never going to be me. Not on an ongoing basis anyway. But I think maybe, and this is progress, it can be me for a day that I can get out of my own head and enjoy the fact that other people are enjoying being subsumed into something larger than themselves, which is their baseball team fandom. I don't believe in that all the time. I don't believe in that we, and that word subsume scares the hell out of me because I don't want to hand over my prerogatives to anybody else who is going to make rules for how we can think and behave and so on. And so much of fandom, especially now that it's all online, seems to me to be consumed with an orthodoxy that is not too different from religion. Just to be clear, that's not the story that Stacy is telling. In fact, the story that she's telling is something much more benign, hopeful, and uplifting, which is a centering of oneself, not a losing of oneself in the crowd, but a finding of oneself among the crowd, using the game, if you will pardon my use of the expression, as home plate. And I thank Stacy for showing me that that was possible. I'm not going to go on for too long here because our opening segment was kind of long, but one part of arriving there for me was that I tried to focus on the good times that I've had at the ballpark. And I tend to think of bad times, the fans who were profane and drunk and belligerent, and most of my experiences were not bad, but nonetheless, it made me, over a period of time, very uncomfortable, so that when I got to a point in my career when regular press credentials or BBWAA membership became a possibility for me, I was much happier to spend my time in the press box, even if it meant that it wasn't spending time with friends and that I had to be silent the whole time and not cheer and so on. I have no problem not cheering. I can very quietly register my approbation or disapproval without expressing it to anyone except my readers or now my listeners. One of the most moving experiences that I ever had actually came as a result of that, and I don't know the exact date, but I think it was somewhere in 2007. And it involved the late Yankees great and broadcaster Bobby Mercer. I remember Mercer very, very fondly, and even then, there's an apology that I kind of have had to make repeatedly in my mind. And the thing you have to know about Mercer is, to all reports that I've heard from people who knew him well, and I do not claim to have known him well or at all, really, he was a very good person. He was also, and people still haven't quite realized this, I think, an incredible baseball player. He was, at one point, the heir to Mickey Mantle, and for a little while, he lived up to that. If you look at his 1971 and 1972 seasons, they're about as good as any season anybody has had anywhere. Because we're still in the backwash of the late 60s pitching-heavy period of baseball. So when, for example, in 1971, he hit .331 with 25 home runs and led the league with a .427 on-base percentage, that's a Mike Trout season. And he wasn't consistent at that level, like Mike Trout is. And what subsequently happened was that while Yankee Stadium was being remodeled 50-plus years into its existence, the Yankees transferred over to Shea Stadium, and Mercer's swing, which had been adapted to his home ballpark, just completely failed him at Shea. And he started to mess around and got away from what he did well. And although he had several good seasons after that point, particularly for the San Francisco Giants in a really tough offensive environment, he never quite got back to that Trout level after 1972. The reason that I have to sometimes issue that mental apology is that when I was young and he was a regular broadcaster for the Yankees, I found many of his observations trite. As the Yankees struggled, he would say things like, "You know what the Yankees need are hitters who can hit." Yeah, that's deep. That's exactly what they need. I mean, you don't need hitters who can't really hit. But the more I listened and the less he tried to provide analysis and was just himself, the more endearing he became. And for me, the transformative moment in my appreciation for him came relatively late in his broadcasting career when Michael Kay brought up the Indians' first baseman, Tony Horton, who had played for them from 1967 through 1970. Horton famously had a series of on-field nervous breakdowns that led to him being unable to play the game after his 25th birthday. Kay was telling these stories and laughing about them. And Mercer interrupted him and said, "Listen, Michael, I played against Tony Horton. I saw some of that stuff happening. There was nothing funny about it. It was a tragedy." And my respect for the man simply mushroomed. Well, flash forward a couple of years. Mercer, who had a history of cancer in his family, was found to have a malignant brain tumor. It was operated on, and he underwent chemotherapy, and he was away from the Yankees for a while. And he was in what turned out to be, sadly, a very brief period of remission. But at that time, he came back to the ballpark. It was something to see. He was greeted so warmly by people. He had always had this big mane of hair, but chemotherapy had taken all of that, so he was bald up there. And I found myself just sitting with him in the dugout at one point. And I said, "Bobby, I just want you to know that I'm a fellow cancer survivor, and I'm rooting for you to lick this thing." And he told me that he appreciated that, and he started to ask me a series of questions about what kind of cancer I'd had. And at that point, I'd only had one. I've had two, but at that time, I had had ocular melanoma. And I told him what I tell many people, that I'm partially blind now, but that's a trade that you would make in exchange for the rest of your life, give up part of your sight in order to not die in your 30s. And I said, given that, I felt very fortunate to make that trade, and that I was very lucky. And Mercer said, "You are not lucky. God had a plan for you, and that's why you're still here." And as I said here a few minutes ago, I'm not a religious person, but I recognize that he was, and that he was saying something to me that was deeply meaningful for him. And so I was as moved by his saying that to me as anything that anyone has ever said to me of positive nature. Even telling you about this now, many years later, and Sadly, Mercer passed away in 2008. I'm choking up telling you about this. It was such a generous thing because this was a man who at that moment probably had a year of time left, and he chose to spend some of it with me, and he chose to try to uplift my feelings when I had been trying to uplift his. Baseball has given me many gifts and many friends that I would not have had otherwise, and many experiences that I would not have had otherwise. And so, yeah, I push back against many aspects of running with the crowd. But if that is what Stacy meant by loving the game that saved me, then, Lord, yes, I love the game. I don't think I can add anything to that, except to say that one of the highest forms of generosity is when a relative stranger takes a moment of their precious time and gives you a gift. One moment to transition from the sublime to the tawdry and capitalistic. First, a word from our sponsors, and then I'll be back with Stacy May Fowles.
If my heart gets in your hair, you mustn't kick it around. If you're bored with this affair, you mustn't kick it around. Even though I'm mild and meek when we have a brawl, if I turn the other cheek, you mustn't kick it at all.
Stacy May Fowles is the author of three novels and numerous pieces at venues too many to mention, and most recently, the author of Baseball Life Advice, Loving the Game That Saved Me. I'm very happy to talk to her now. How are you, Stacy?
I'm great. I'm very happy to be here.
Thank you. So we're talking the day after Thanksgiving in America, and appropriately for a Toronto Blue Jays fan, you're somewhere in the wilds of Canada. I know you're probably in the Toronto metropolitan area somewhere, but yeah. I'm just going to broadly refer to it as the wilds of Canada for we ignorant Americans who don't know where anything is. But it was yesterday just a typical Thursday in Canada? Do you take any notice of our American holiday?
Well, I mean, the thing that struck me was you're all posting photos of your food. And it seems really unfair because I am a big fan of Thanksgiving food, especially stuffing.
Yes.
And it occurred to me there should be a restaurant chain that's just Thanksgiving food. I don't know why that doesn't exist. So you could have Thanksgiving at any point you wanted to.
We have stuff like that, stuffing, stuff like that. There are chains that will do Thanksgiving sandwiches. There used to be a restaurant
yeah.
in New York that I would go to that had, like, on the menu all year round, Thanksgiving on a roll, which was, you know, a turkey sandwich with cranberry and stuffing in there. I'm sure it was great for you health-wise. But, mm-hmm. yeah, you're absolutely right. That's the good part, because many people find the family part traumatic. But
the food part, it's all right.
Yeah.
It's funny, because I actually have a poultry intolerance, which is a really bizarre thing about me that I'm very embarrassed about. So I can't partake in turkey. So usually my Thanksgiving involves things like fish or pork or sometimes a steak, which is a bit strange. So I'm not particularly jealous of the turkey aspect of things, but the sides, there's so many good sides.
I actually agree with you, because the turkey is a bird that is very easily abused in the cooking. And I was saying this in the last episode of the show, that the person in my family who cooks the turkey, their practice is to put it in the oven about August 30th so that it's just really thoroughly dry by the time that November comes around. And I was saying, why can't we have pizza? Why can't we have lasagna? Why does it have – they didn't have turkey at the actual Thanksgiving. I don't know what they had. They might have eaten skunk for all I know. So why can't we just vary it up? Nobody likes turkey.
No. I feel like it's a conduit meat, turkey. It's how you season it. It's not the meat itself.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's that was part of my argument, because there are so many older people in my family who can't do salt and can't do seasoning. So to accommodate them, they don't. And so once you've gotten to that point, I think you should admit that you've lost the battle and that you just can't do turkey.
And at that point, the whole world opens up to you. Maybe it's a little carbohydrate heavy to have pizza with stuffing, but, you know, I'm up for that.
Is there any segue to baseball here? Is there any witty way we can get, like, people have salty opinions about baseball? I'm reaching.
Well, I was going to ask you one other question about the differences between the way that we observe things, because I've been to Canada not many times, but I've been there a few times. And one of my favorite memories of being there, and I'd be really curious if you had a similar experience. Now, this might have been closer to Montreal than Toronto. I'm not positive because it was a long time ago. But I took a river tour, and the tour guide, as we went around along the river for a couple of hours, would point out some object on the bank and say, "This is where you invaded in 1776 and we kicked your American ass and sent you crying back home. This is where you invaded in 1812 and we kicked your ass and sent you." And it was actually a very positive experience for me. It was a lesson in humility that I've never quite forgotten. And I wondered if that was a typical experience. Are Canadians indoctrinated that way? Or did I just happen to have a salty, to use that word, tour guide?
I find it funny that this conversation is starting off with the Canadian American antagonism, but the interesting thing is I actually lived in Georgia for about a year and a half when I was a teenager, and I learned different history than I did in Canada, and I couldn't now in retrospect tell you exactly what different things I learned, but there was definitely a different perspective on the way things unfolded. So I think that Canadians probably have a very different perspective on American history and Canadian history than Americans do. That is definitely true.
And here's my segue, Stacey.
Wait for it.
Is there a similar difference in the way that we observe baseball? Is there a difference in being a Toronto Blue Jays baseball fan than there is in being a fan in one of the lower 48 states?
So here's an interesting thing. Something happened to us in Toronto in 2015. We spent a very long time being irrelevant, as you may know,
right.
As a team. And Canadians have this sort of like, aw shucks kind of thing going on. You know, there's this, I remember growing up and when the American media mentioned Canada in any way, we'd get excited. and you know, we sort of have this like little brother to the North complex going on. And 2015 sort of marked in baseball, we became relevant, right? It had been a very long time since we had been a relevant team in any way whatsoever. And there was this adjustment, this psychological adjustment that had to happen, that we were, you know, a contending team. And I think that the Jays actually sort of changed the city of Toronto in a lot of ways, in a baseball sense, because baseball was never really that important to Toronto, you know, at least in my recent memory. So, you know, I would say 2015, we sort of grappled with our own relevance. 2016, we may have gotten a little bit cocky. And 2017, well, you know, how that turned out. So, but I do think that Toronto has definitely become more of a baseball town in the last few years, you know, and it's been, you know, as a baseball fan, as somebody who sat in that stadium when 5,000 people showed up, it's a really lovely thing to see. It's been really fun to watch this rejuvenation of baseball culture in Toronto and in the country. I mean, you know, we only have one team. So, you know, I went to Calgary to promote Baseball Life Advice, and it was amazing to me how many people in Calgary were incredibly diehard baseball fans. There's a whole baseball culture out there. And, you know, it's something you wouldn't think about, you know, if you didn't have a team, an MLB team to call your own. So, yeah, no, it's interesting that we, you know, some people want to call the Jays Canada's team, which I think some people take offense to. But I do think it's interesting to have a team in which a whole country is behind that team instead of, you know, specific cities.
The memories for me of 92 and 93 in those championships are so visceral for some reason because those teams were so good. Why is that funny?
I thought you were going to say vivid, and instead you said visceral. And I was like, oh. Yeah, and it's interesting because I was 12, 13, 14 around that time. And so it was a very formative time for me as a human being. And so, you know, I think if you were that age when your city's team did so incredibly well, it really sort of solidifies your baseball brain, right? So I had this amazing memory of this, you know, these just wonderful baseball moments that I shared with my dad when I was that age. And then to wait so like multiple decades to sort of have those experiences again was a really, I mean, 2015, a lot of wonderful things have happened to me in my life. I always say that 2015 was like the best year of my life because we had those old baseball feelings back. And I think it was, you know, in terms of the book, it was, you know, it felt so obvious to start writing about those feelings and the things that happened during that year for this city.
Well, let's talk about that. The subtitle is Loving the Game That Saved Me. So how did the game save you?
So you rewind a little bit back in time to 2011. And I was in a particular dark place. I was dealing with my first diagnosed depression. I'd experienced anxiety for a lot of my life, but never depression. And it was a whole new experience for me. And I have this sort of distinct memory of watching the baseball postseason from my couch under a blanket. And of all people, Justin Verlander was pitching in the postseason. And I had this sort of distinct feeling of, I really care about this thing. I really love this thing. And I think anybody who's experienced mental illness will tell you that when you're depressed, it's really hard to care about anything.
Absolutely.
And the fact that I cared about Justin Verlander and, you know, that was a Cy Young year for him. He was just incredible. And it sort of brought me back to the game. I'd been, you know, a casual fan of the game. I would say that, you know, in my teen years, I was really into baseball, but then this thing kind of happens where, you know, sports aren't cool, you know, in my 20s and I sort of drifted away, but it was around that time that I came back to it and I poured myself into a love of the game sparked by Justin Verlander throwing some pitches. And, you know, it's interesting that, you know, I write about it in the book and I talk about that experience and it's an interesting little full circle that, you know, he won the World Series this year for me, I think. because I, you know, I look back on that time and I feel like my life is so different since, you know, and my perspective is so different. And I think that baseball in so many different ways played a huge part in my recovery. And at first I thought that was sort of absurd, like what a weird thing to, you know, baseball as baseball as therapy. But the more I talk to people, the more I realize that, you know, this game has accompanied them through so many difficult things in their lives, whether it's grief or illness or loss, divorce, all sorts of things. So I think that it's a familiar sentiment that people attach themselves to a game or a love or an interest outside themselves, and that helps them get through.
I think so. I mean, one of the things with anxiety and depression, and I've often been told that they're two sides of the same coin, that one is an indicator of the other. They're often just expressing themselves. They're picking which side to express themselves on, is changing your focus. But of course, the problem with both is that they make you a little bit obsessive because you're either focusing on your panic or you're focusing on the miserable messages that you're getting from your brain about your mood or your life or your experiences. So it doesn't necessarily have to be baseball. It could be Star Trek or, for a lot of people, religion. But I think baseball is really greatly amenable to that. Especially, I think, because of the sense of community that being a fan brings with it.
Oh, absolutely. And I, you know, in some ways for me, it was just as simple as having something to look forward to, you know, especially over the winter, right? there's this amazing sort of, you know, the winter is bleak for a great number of people. And to have that day in February when it's still awful, to look forward to, where literally all that happens is a bunch of guys walk on a field and start working out. But like to look forward to that pitchers and catchers reporting in such a passionate way is a really good way to see yourself through, you know, short days. And I mean, it's dark at 5 p.m. now, you know, and for some reason, this sort of repetitive idea of pitchers and catches are reporting in 100 days, in 80 days, just really helps people get through. And, you know, when you're depressed, even something as simple as, well, tomorrow there's going to be another game. That helped me a great deal. And it's, I mean, it sounds so simple and it's something that you take for granted when you're feeling well, but it really did. It just really helped me. And absolutely what you're saying, the community aspect of things and sort of a shared love and a shared, you know, to get earnest, but a shared faith and hope in something. And also to love something frivolous, right? I mean, I think that no matter how diehard a baseball fan you are, you realize that it is, quote unquote, just a game. And there's something really lovely about loving something that is just a game. It's almost childlike, if you will.
It absolutely is. And what you say about pitchers and catchers, it's so counterintuitive in a way, because, as you said, nothing really happens that day. And nothing happens.
What a great day.
Right, it is. It's a great day. And you might see, I mean, before the internet and everything, I always remember there'd be about 5 seconds on the local news. You know, pitchers and catchers report today, and you'd see the catchers doing squats or drills or something. And then they'd go on to the next thing. And then it's a couple of weeks before there are actual games, and then there's a month worth of games. I tend to feel that spring training is too long in some ways. It just seems to stretch on forever. But it's hard for me to be cynical about pitchers and catchers, because it's such a liberation. It's almost like, you know, George Harrison in Here Comes the Sun singing, "Little Darling, It's Been a Long, Cold, Lonely Winter." It really, I had this fantasy for the longest time of a commercial during the Super Bowl that you would pull back from the TV and see Ken Griffey Jr. practicing his swing next to a Christmas tree or something. And just superimposed on that would be, you know, "Don't worry, we're coming." And
yeah,
you need that. You need that first budding of the tree. It's a cliche maybe, but it really is a liberation when it happens.
Well, and in the book, I talk a lot about scaffolding, right? This idea of that one of the greatest therapeutic models is structure. And I think a lot of people who, you know, people who suffer during the winter, you know, part of it has to do with the fact that, you know, because the days are shorter, you don't have the same activity levels, you're not doing the same things that you usually do. And even the structure of baseball, how repetitive it is, how it always comes back, right? It's,
right.
You know, it very predictably comes back every year at almost the same day. And yeah, you know, I find myself like, it's cold in Toronto. We're supposed to have a traditional Canadian winter in Toronto this year, which,
oh, no.
Yay. But I always find myself, you know, in my parka, and those photos come, you know, those photos come in mid-February of, you know, guys in t-shirts, in their new team t-shirts that have been handed out. And I just want to look at them, because they just say it's almost over. You're very close now. So yeah, I mean, you can look at it from a mental health perspective, or you can look at it from a perspective of like, it's just the summer is nice. So, I mean, it can be that basic.
So does the outcome for the team change your point of view and its benefit to you at those times? Because, you know, you were saying this goes back to 2011. Well, the Blue Jays were a 500 team that year, and then they had a couple more losing years before turning it around. In 15 and 16, you had the playoff appearances for the first time since those World Series we talked about. And then this year, a little bit of a disappointment, or a lot of a disappointment, depending on
a little bit of a disappointment. That's very kind of you. I mean, I think it comes down to expectations, right? So when I was going to games in the aughts, you know, and 2000, those 2012 games, those 2013 games, I didn't have a lot of expectation, right? I just wanted to see some baseball. And I really enjoyed it because it, you know, you just go to a game and you enjoy a game and you don't really, in your heart of hearts, you hope and you get excited, but you're not in a position where you think, you know, this year the Jays are going to the World Series. But once 2015 and 2016 happened, it looked like it was possible, right? And the team looked different. Everything felt different. The 2015 team just felt like a championship team, and it was an incredible. The feeling was incredible. I think like anything, it's, you know, if you start out with these expectations, inevitably you can be disappointed. So I think that in 2017, a lot of people in the fan base had very high expectations for where this team was going to go. And we started off the season in such a dismal way. I don't remember exactly how many games we lost in April, but it was demoralizing. And I think that just set the tone for the entire season for a lot of people. They just felt it was hard to see silver lining because there had been these really high expectations. The start was so dismal that a lot of people took that feeling throughout the season. But, you know, as somebody who writes about baseball, I often felt like it was my job to sort of step back and look at all the beautiful little narratives that were happening within.
Right.
And that's what I tried to do.
They went 8-17. And I mean, that's a pace for well over 100 losses. And it's just one of those, I mean, they didn't wind up. Yeah, I did. And I mean, that didn't happen. It wasn't that bad, but it's one of those things, given that they were a better club than that, it just happens. It's baseball just does that to you.
Yeah. And I think that was the hardest thing, is that we all knew that they were better than their record. And there were terrible injuries. You know, Donaldson was out for a long time. It just felt like this mix of bad luck and underperformance, and it just was not great. but I think it also sort of, you know, it's, and I will admit there were times where I had to look away. but I think that, you know, for me, it was, you know, there was a lot of trying to get back to why I love this game in the first place. And, you know, I had these incredible experiences in 2015 and 2016 with the wild card game and, you know, the bat flip game. And it can't always be like that, right?
No.
It can't always be the greatest baseball experience you've ever had. So you have to, you know, if you're going to devote yourself to this game, you have to look for the smaller moments, the, you know, not the moments that are worthy of, you know, to be blown up and framed on your living room wall, but, you know, the smaller moments, like a man diving over a catcher to get safe at home, right? That's what you have to be looking for. And I, you know, it sounds very cliche, but I think that's what a great metaphor for life.
Steve here, interrupting with one last word from our sponsors, which, given this program's nature, should be from Studebaker or Bermashave or some other anachronistic thing, but no, it's something you can actually buy. It's useful that way. We'll be back in just a moment.
It absolutely is, because you have to take it as it comes. And I mean, this is going to sound a little snobby maybe, but I feel like what you're talking about is almost the highest form of being a baseball fan. And you say throughout the book, if you're out of town, if you're traveling, you make a point of hitting one of the other ball clubs, and you're not as invested in, say, a Angels A's game, just to like arbitrarily pick a matchup. But you're going to go and you're going to have a great time for a lot of reasons that don't have anything to do with a parochial investment in the outcome.
Oh yeah, for sure. And sometimes I think it's actually quite relaxing to go to a game where you don't particularly care about who wins or who loses, right? You know, and I think in your gut, you sort of like during the course of the game, you sort of develop an allegiance, you know, and it's kind of fun when that happens, when all of a sudden you care about a team for some arbitrary reason in the moment. Yeah, no, it's part of the reason why I really enjoyed the World Series this year was because I couldn't pick a side. I had all these feelings for Verlander, but then, you know, the Dodgers had so many great players that I loved, and it was just, it was really difficult for me to, at any point, pick who I wanted to come out triumphant. And it got to a point where all I wanted was 7 games.
Right.
I was like, oh, just please be 7. You know?
And it kind of had to be. It had to be 7 because both of them were evenly matched in a lot of ways. They were both great teams. And it didn't need to end it. It could still be going inconclusively. That was the wonderful thing about this World Series.
Yeah, and in the end, I'm glad that the Astros won, but I don't, and this sounds strange, I want to say this correctly, I don't actually think that the better team won.
Right.
But I would say that even if the Dodgers had won. You know, I feel like the two teams that should have been in the World Series were in the World Series.
Yes.
And it didn't necessarily matter who won.
Right. There's kind of a negative version of that I always like to quote. In the 1944 World Series was the Browns and the Cardinals, and it was all these players who were 4F, all the stars like Joe DiMaggio and so on, or most of them were in military service. And so a sports writer was asked to handicap the series, and he was asked which team could win, and he said neither. And I mean, that's kind of the negative part of it, but it's just it's the same idea, I think.
Exactly. It was just, you know, and it, we just lucked out. Like, how lucky were we to watch that World Series? I think it was one of the more, you know, I don't know if I'm becoming more invested as a fan, so I feel more interested in the World Series, or if it's that this particular World Series was one of the more compelling. But I just feel like we all of us who were not intensely invested in the Dodgers or intensely invested in the Astros really lucked out, because we got a really good end to our October and beginning of November, right?
Yeah, we absolutely did. To return to the 17 Blue Jays for a second before we go back to the book.
Why are we going back there?
Well, actually, it does dovetail with the book, because, you know, you're writing these pieces in some cases over a year ago or 2 years ago. And so I have the benefit of hindsight as I'm reading it. So at one point, I think Jose Bautista was a free agent, and you said something like, I hope they resign them. And it was, for me, again, having the benefit of hindsight, it was like, you know, the person who shouts at the movie screen in the horror movie saying, no, don't go in that room, Stacy. And so I was curious what it was like to watch him go through the season that he had, which presumably will be his last season with Toronto.
Yeah, it was, I actually think in the end, I think that the fan base and the team did him a great deal of justice in terms of what he's brought to the city and the franchise. He's a legend, right? He was the face of this team. He is the face of this team right now. I think that as disappointing as it is to watch someone with that level of greatness have a difficult season, I think the way it played out in the end, like the tributes to him and the way the fan base was feeling about him, it was actually quite a lovely, warm thing. And I know that he's not the most beloved character league-wide, but in some ways that made us love him more, I think. I think that we were very... I hate saying were.
I'm sorry.
We are very proud to call him ours. It was very emotional, those last games, and interesting because, you know, nothing was said or done, right? It wasn't like his fate had been sealed and his future was known. It was just that we all knew that this was kind of the end, and that there was, you know, this kind of impromptu tribute to him. So it's hard for me to sort of like look at the season and talk about how disappointing it was or how, you know, he wasn't up to his full potential and he wasn't performing the way he should have, because I just think about the end of the season after it was obvious that the Jays were not a contender and you know, the magic number was no longer magic. And, you know, we were more focused as a fan base. I think we were more focused on saying goodbye to him in a way that was that honored what he'd given us. So, yeah, I it's me being, you know, always the optimist. And I just think that that was a nice way to end a season that wasn't necessarily it didn't necessarily play out the way it should have.
One of the things,
or the way we wanted it to, I guess.
Well, what I was going to say is that it never does, and that when you have an emotional investment in both a team and a player, sometimes those investments come into conflict, because eventually, as all of these guys age at whatever rate that they age, and Bautista was 36, and some players manage to maintain their peak a little longer, some go much earlier than that, you kind of have a choice to make between rooting for a winning baseball team and rooting for a player. Because, I mean, at his current skill level, maybe Bautista is no longer a championship-level player. We'll hope that if he signs with someone, he has a bounce-back year. But that division between goals, between loving a player and loving a team, I think in a way is one of the hardest things for fans to navigate, but also one of the most wonderful things about the game, that it teaches you that you have to make that choice sometimes.
Yeah, and I mean, I think there's the third option of loving baseball, right? Which I think some of us sort of fall into allegiances with a particular team, but, you know, what we really love is the game, right? And I think that anybody who loves the game, they want the legends to go out on a high point, right? That's what they want. But yeah, no, you're absolutely right. There's a lesson, like, it can't all be Derek Jeter, right?
Right.
It can't all be David Ortiz, right? David Ortiz's farewell tour is probably the best case scenario, right, for a player. You know, he was great, and, you know, everybody knew it was the end, and he was fed it at every stop, you know. and we see things like that and we think, well, this is the way it is, and maybe it's the way it is in a best case scenario, right? I sort of leave it to the organization now. Like, I'm, you know, there better be a bronze statue of Jose Bautista outside the Sky Dome, or I can't even.
Well, where does he rank? Like, I don't have, in terms of say growing up a Yankees fan, I mean, you know, you had Babe Ruth and Mickey Mantle and Joe DiMaggio and these guys that would be invoked constantly, even if they were decades gone from being active players. They were just always a presence. For the Blue Jays, who have a much shorter history but do have some wonderful things, like a third base platoon in which the names were Garth and Rance, that was my first sense as a kid, that the Blue Jays were somehow a foreign entity, because there was no American team with guys named Garth and Rance. And Rance actually became one of my favorite players. He was such a good hitter. Is it Dave Steeb and Lloyd Mosby and Jesse Barfield, and then Bautista is in there somewhere too?
Yeah, and I mean, I think if you look at just raw numbers, he's definitely up there. But I think probably most importantly, you cannot overestimate how important to a city in a baseball culture the bat flip moment was. Like, it sounds so ridiculous, but I mean, it is the kind of thing that we never shut up about. Right, we never will shut up about, because it was just, we didn't get to have moments like that for the longest time. You know, he was an incredible player before that. He was, you know, he was the face of the team. He was the, you know, the leader. He was a character. He was so many things. But that moment, I cannot properly express. I will be writing about that moment until I die. Like, things like that, like, it's, you know, you can talk about numbers and you can talk, but the way a player lives in our historical memory of this game, it's, everybody knows about that, right? It's part of the reason why he's so strongly disliked, but it's also one of the reasons he's so beloved.
Well, and I think eventually we'll dwell more on the latter, the beloved part, because it really changed the culture of the game, and you saw it a lot in the postseason. And I do realize that the next season he and Rougned Odor had that fight at second base over that same incident. And I think there was another incident with Bautista with the Braves this year because he flipped his bat early in the season. But on the whole, it suddenly became much more acceptable to be demonstrative that way in a way it hadn't been in the whole history of baseball.
Yeah, and I mean, if you look at, you know, the World Baseball Classic at the beginning of last season, there was a lot of really fun stuff happening there in terms of, you know, animated, enthusiastic baseball. If you look at Puig during the World Series, like, it definitely just started us talking about this idea of old school rules and enthusiasm and, you know, drama in this game. And it hasn't always been the most productive conversation. I do like that Bautista falls into that camp of showing your emotions, right? You know, Stroman is the same. I think it's really fun for people who are new to the game. It's really fun for people who have loved the game for years, right? So I think that players like Bautista and a number of other players really sort of bring an emotional side to this game that is really enjoyable for a lot of people.
Now, I think we've been missing it, and this has come up on other episodes of the show, that there were historical reasons for that kind of not celebrating, because in a culture of baseball where it was more acceptable to throw at people and so on, that anybody who felt embarrassed, there might be a violent backlash to it. And again, as we saw with Odor, there still might be. But I think that the culture has changed sufficiently that not only is it maybe more understood that, look, if you give up a home run, you give up a home run, and the way to get even is to hit a home run yourself.
Yes. Yeah, I like that form of revenge.
Catfish Hunter, you know, the Hall of Fame pitcher, his one flaw was he gave up a lot of home runs. He would go into the dugout after the inning and say, "Did you see that one? If that one..."
Awesome.
I mean, I think that's a great attitude. There, you don't, it doesn't all, I like the, I love the era, in fact, of, you know, the dead ball era, and these guys are literally playing for, at this Dickensian level of survival, really, and that's a neat thing to think about, but that's not where we are now, when everyone's a millionaire.
Yes, of course.
So, I love the evocations in the book of your dad. And he's obviously, well, everybody's father is really important in their lives one way or another, but he was the person who introduced you to the game and is someone who you still take in ball games with and is important to your life. And I was struck by, and you know, to be honest, I'm not sure there's really a question in here exactly, but there's a parallel in my own life, because both of our fathers were immigrants. Your dad came over from Great Britain, I believe, and settled in Toronto at the exact same moment, roughly, that the Blue Jays appeared. And my father was an immigrant and came over a couple of decades earlier and settled in Brooklyn, where there were the Dodgers. And both of them chose baseball as their vehicles of assimilation. But the difference was that for my dad at that point, the Dodgers moved and he became disillusioned with the game. And so I had to find my own way in, because he had kind of given up on it at that point, whereas your dad seems to have stuck with it. And it just struck me how, again, this is part of being a baseball fan too, that like, you can give yourself over to this outside thing, but you can't guarantee that it will always treat you the way that you need it to treat you.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And also, I mean, you can give the game to someone, but you can't force them to love it. That's another thing that is a particular struggle in my life. I mean, baseball is obviously a huge, huge part of my life, but I don't actually have a lot of friends who love baseball in the same way I do. So, which is sort of interesting if you think about it. I mean, my friends will oblige me and they will come and they'll have a nice day, because, I mean, a ballpark is a nice place to be. It's sunny. There's beer. It's, you know, it's not an objectionable place to spend a couple of hours. I think the interesting thing about my relationship with my dad and going to the ballpark is that when he was taking me to the ballpark, he didn't really have any sort of long history of love of this game, right? It was as new to him as it was to me. There was this nice thing about us learning about the game together. Obviously, I was a child, so I didn't really understand statistics or, you know, the more complicated rules. But he wasn't bringing this sort of long history of you must love baseball with him, right? So that was what made it. He sort of gave me the room to love the game in my own way. And, you know, at a certain point, my love of it outpaced his love of it. and his interest in it is now, it's waned comparatively. But there was no, you know, I think I talk about in the book how there was no obligation for me to love baseball. And I think that kind of love is actually much stronger and much healthier, obviously.
It occurred to me that there's an alternate reality in which he had just stuck to the culture he brung with him, and that we could be currently discussing cricket life advice.
No, for sure. Well, and I often think that about the book, right? I think that one of, you know, a lot of the feedback I get on the book is that, you know, people who don't care about baseball can identify with it, because it's really, I believe that one reviewer said it was a book about love. But, you know, people find a thing that they become almost absurdly obsessed with. And it's a good thing. It's about giving yourself to something that is, and I've said it before, frivolous, right? It doesn't demand anything of you, and you just love it unabashedly for whatever reason you love it. And, you know, I could write and write and write and never really get to the bottom of why baseball was the thing that appeared when I needed it. But it doesn't go away, right? It doesn't, you know, I don't get bored of it. I don't get tired of it. I get frustrated with it, but I don't, you know, I don't, it's just always there in the back of my mind. It's, you know, it's a nice thing. I'm totally going to go into cheesy platitudes. You
know, well, so. I will cut you off and say that you mentioned that you don't have a ton of friends who are into the game, but that, and again, and this is also one of the best parts of the book for me, that when you met your husband, he was not a big sports fan, but he picked it up through you, the love of baseball specifically. And one, I think that's a wonderful thing, because as a longtime observer of relationships, mine and others, and recognizing that, like icebergs, two-thirds of them are always beneath the surface and you can't really see what's going on unless you're living it. I never understand those couples who seem to have nothing in common but still go on year after year after year living almost very separate lives and yet theoretically still loving each other. But so I think that any time that couples kind of cleave together over something, I think it's this positive thing. But that he picked Diner Navarro as his gateway drug. And I just wonder if at any point, as thrilled as you probably were that he was coming towards you in this way, that you cautioned him that kind of a backup catcher bordering on regular status was not the most stable basis on which to base one's affections.
Well, his reasoning was so nice. It was, he seems like a really nice guy. Like, what nice reasoning to, like, and as somebody who was a longtime Adam Lind fan, I can't judge that. I'm not like, he just liked him. And I think that, you know, I think we've, it's really easy to, you know, like an MVP, you know, it's like, oh, Aaron Judge is my favorite player. Oh, okay. Like, but when somebody is just like, I just really like that Navarro, you know that they've found a way in. I think the thing that I'm trying to sort of talk about in that piece is how nice it is to sit and watch somebody become a fan of something you love. You can't force it. You can't make them love a thing that you care about. But once you start to notice, you know, I had this lovely experience, like my husband would come home with facts or stats, or, you know, he'd see something at work and he'd be like, did you hear what happened today? And it was just a really nice thing, because I knew that I hadn't forced it on him. I mean, that might be debatable because I made him go to spring training. But, you know, it was just nice to see him develop his own interest in the game. And, you know, I think baseball fans, we have this experience a lot where, you know, we'll bring somebody to their first game or, you know, they haven't been in a long time. And you sort of get to see somebody connect with the game in a way that you may be taking for granted. And I had an experience where I took a couple of friends and they were like, why is everybody singing now? And like, and they all really wanted a hot dog because that's what you're supposed to want. And those are the kinds of things that, you know, when you're going to dozens of games a year, you completely take for granted.
I've had some wonderful experiences at the ballpark, obviously, and I've had some that are not so great. And this is also a theme that runs throughout the book, that sometimes you have to make concessions to the fact that people who sit in a certain section or in different ballparks may be more intoxicated or more antisocial than other people. And sometimes that's a gender specific kind of thing that perhaps male fans don't have to deal with. And I shouldn't say perhaps, it's just they don't have to deal with it. But one thing that I learned from your book, it made me focus more on the positive experiences than the negative ones. And as someone who, like you, experiences depression and anxiety, I sometimes use that as an excuse not to sit in the stands or prefer to get a press credential, because usually sports writers are a lot more contained and professional than that. One story that occurred to me that I wanted to share with you because it seems so consonant with what you were writing about was that in 1992, I went to Yankee Stadium on the most torrential rainy day. And it was the last day or one of the last days that actually the Toronto Blue Jays were going to be in town that year. They were, as we discussed earlier, on their way to the World Series. Even though the weather on any other day of the year, I think it would have been rained out. It was raining that heavily. The Yankees were out of it and just wanted to get the gate in. And the Blue Jays put David Cone out there because they had acquired him as a rental. He was going to be a free agent at the end of the year. So, you know, who cared if he threw 120 pitches in what was basically a hurricane? Just a freezing, freezing rain. And I had to be there because one of my friends, I was in college at the time, was applying for a job. I don't remember if it was an internship or an actual job with the Yankees, which he did eventually get and worked there for many years. He left me and a friend in the stands. We were given no special treatment while he went up into the offices. And the way old Yankee Stadium was constructed, the upper deck was much nearer to the field than it is in current stadiums. And so as the rain came down, it would hit the middle deck and we were sitting right under it and it created a waterfall. And it was just like I was taking this icy shower throughout the game, and so were the other fans around me. And about one section over were two young couples who were clearly on a date of some kind. And they had, like me, not really come equipped for the weather. I watched these two young women with these guys just shivering, huddling together. And at one point, the two guys just disappeared, leaving the two women shaking in the stands. And I thought, oh, God, that's awful. What, they like go off for beers and leave these girls here? But when I next looked over, both the girls were suddenly sporting team jackets, and not like the cheap knockoff ones, but like the expensive, fully tricked out team coats. And I thought this was the most awesome gesture that I had ever seen anybody make on a date or anywhere else. And I swore to myself that if I were ever in that position with someone I cared about, that I would do the same thing. It seems like that's the kind of thing when you talk about, and not just the things that we've said, the routines of baseball and the day in and day out of it, whether you win or not. But again, the community of it, the fact that people can be good as part of loving this thing, I mean, that's the value of the game.
You're actually reminding me of a story where I went to Yankee Stadium on opening day one year. I can't remember exactly what year it was, but it was so cold and I was so inappropriately dressed and I bought a Yankee sweatshirt and it was like a Jays game. And I bought this Yankee sweatshirt and I like hid it underneath my flimsy jacket. And every single time I wore it, the Jays won. So I had this whole like conflicting feeling about wearing this Yankee sweatshirt. Yankees gear is just one thing I just can't do. You know, I have this like go to a ballpark, buy a cap thing always.
Right.
But Yankees gear, I'm just like, oh, I can't. But this sweatshirt is lucky for the Jays. Like, anyway, yes, to your point, there are a lot of things I talk about in the book that there is a darker side of this game and that it's not all roses and sunshine and feeling good. It can disappoint you not only in the sense of loss, but in the sense of, you know, for a lot of people, they feel very excluded from the culture of this game. It's interesting that you just said that you have less anxiety in the press box. I have more anxiety in the press box because there are not a lot of people like me in the press box. So it's, you know, my experience in spring training last year, there was, I think, 28 men and 2 women in the press box. So, you know, it is not perfect. There needs to be some major changes. There needs to be some serious conversations. But this game has also helped me see a really positive side of humanity when I really needed to see it. And, you know, the way we connect to each other via sports is a really beautiful thing. And I don't think it can be underestimated. And I don't think it can just be brushed off as silly. The amount of love that can be in a room when a team is doing well and everybody's cheering for that team, the very simple idea of rooting for strangers. Like I've never met Justin Verlander. What do I care that he won the World Series and got married and, you know, had a really great Thanksgiving? What difference does it make, you know? But we feel so good for these people we've never met when we see them dousing each other in champagne and celebrating a victory. We actually feel good. And how often do we get that experience, right? We live in a very sort of hateful, jealous culture. People can be terribly cruel to each other. And to have this opportunity to root for strangers is a really... See, I'm falling into platitudes again, but I really do... I do believe that, you know, and I say this in the book, that my sports fandom actually shows me the best version of myself. And it shows me a version of myself that, you know, when I was depressed, I didn't know existed. So I'm very grateful for it.
No, you're absolutely right. And one of the things that struck me in the immediate aftermath of the World Series, and maybe you saw this, when Carlos Correa proposed to his girlfriend, I thought that was a wonderful moment. And I clicked over to Twitter, or maybe I was already tweeting during the game, and some guy was criticizing that. And I thought, what is wrong with you? Come join the rest of us over here. Like, normally
I understand the criticisms of public proposals. There's a lot of very valid criticisms of public proposals for a lot of reasons. But I think that the one thing that people talked about around that particular proposal was that moment was his.
Right.
And he made it about her. Which makes it different than a lot of these others. Like, you know, there was that, was there not a public proposal where, you know, there was an Olympian who just won a medal and then her partner proposed? And I was kind of like, oh.
Right.
She's like, that's her Olympic moment that you just turned into a proposal. Yeah, that aside, I do think that there's like a lot of, there is a lot of magic that happens, and there's, you know, and you see it between players from other teams, and you see, you know, this incredible camaraderie that happens. And I don't know, I just think that it sports do have the capacity to remind us of the best aspects of our humanity.
And I think that is the perfect place to leave it. Stacey, thank you very much for coming by and having this conversation with me. I enjoyed it greatly.
Real pleasure to be here. And I would be remiss in not plugging the book before we go.
And also the news. How do people get the newsletter? We should bring that up too.
Yeah, you just need to sign up at tinyletter.com/StaceyMayFowles. I got some good news today that Baseball Life Advice is now in another printing. So
awesome.
Yeah. It makes a great holiday gift.
With an introduction by Cy Young Award winner.
R.A. Dickey. That's correct.
Yeah. So
also a great example of humanity. So there you go.
Go out and buy the book. As we're speaking, Black Friday, no doubt it's on sale somewhere. So once again, thank you very much, Stacey.
Thank you.
By Lincoln's merciful beard, we have come to the end of another episode. You can follow Stacey May Fowles on Twitter at Miss Stacey May, M-I-S-S. You can also follow me at Go Stephen Goldman. Why Go Stephen Goldman? Because at Gowanus Canal Stephen Goldman would be too toxic for fishing. You can also write us, well, me, at infiniteinning@gmail.com. You don't even need a stamp. We have a sponsor now. But nonetheless, this episode is brought to you by the number 19. My producer has absconded. He went off to India to follow the Beatles. When I explained that they had last been there 40 years ago, he said, obla-di, obla-da, life goes on, brah. And I just hummed, you can't do that, and let him head on out the door. Our theme song, which you are hearing now and have heard throughout the episode, was co-authored by myself and Dr. Rick Mooring, who was in fact my seatmate at the rainy game that I described to Stacy. He didn't buy me a jacket, but then we didn't have that kind of relationship. Well, if Dave Winfield doesn't throw a copy of a Graham Greene novel at a seagull and blame me for the fatality, I'll be back next week with more tales and discussion from inside the infinite innings.